Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the continuing meltdown of the Trump campaign following a Bloomberg report that Trump instructed his supporters to attack the press and double down on the racist smears against the federal judge presiding over the Trump University case, who Trump refers to as a Mexican and a hater. Adele Stan, a columnist for The American Prospect, joins us to discuss the dysfunction at the heart of Trump's campaign, or non-campaign, as the candidate strikes out at his critics with increasing stridency while his top campaign managers fight amongst themselves and leading Republican figures, including a prospective running mate, Newt Gingrich, distance themselves from Trump's attacks on the judge. Then we'll look into whether the recent historic move by the German parliament to recognize the Armenian genocide played into the hands of Turkish genocide denialists, confirming their belief that the accusations are inspired by anti-Turkish politics rather than historical truth. Nicholas Danforth, a doctoral candidate in Turkish history at Georgetown University, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, The Impeccably Bad Timing of Germany's Armenia Genocide Vote, and what can be done to stop the unraveling of the Turkey-EU refugee deal and restrain President Erdogan's increasingly autocratic rule. Then finally, we'll assess the latest polls in Britain ahead of the June 23 Brexit vote, which indicate the Leave vote is edging ahead of the Remain vote, a development that is alarming officials on both sides of the Atlantic, with Fed Chair Janet Yellen warning today of, quote, significant economic repercussions on U.S. markets, which will be impacted by an adverse reaction in European financial markets. Harold Clark, a professor in the School of Economic, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas and the co-investigator of the British Election Study at the University of Manchester, joins us to discuss the competing scare campaigns, with Remain warning of dire economic consequences and Leave warning of waves of immigrants swamping England's shores. And joining us now is Adele Stan, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently a columnist for The American Prospect, where she just wrote the article, Yes, Donald Trump Could Win the Presidency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Adele, let's spend the next 15 minutes convincing ourselves and our listeners that Donald Trump may not win the presidency, but may in fact resign as a candidate for president rather than face humiliation and
at the hands of a woman.
Public ridicule, yes. At the hands of, well, actually it's two women, because Hillary Clinton's tag-teaming with Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth Warren is just brilliant on Twitter. She really is.
Well, she apparently really gets under his skin. But just to focus in on the Bloomberg story out today, which adds further, I think, evidence of a meltdown at the very top inside this campaign of Trump's, or this, in effect, non-campaign, because it really isn't a campaign. It's just Donald Trump. And he has Manafort and his crew writing strategies that Trump doesn't follow or listen to. And then he's got Corey Lewandowski, his kind of body man, with him at all times, along with the press lady, Hicks. And they're fighting amongst themselves. And the Bloomberg story is basically about this call that took place yesterday with Trump and his supporters, like Jan Brewer, the former Arizona governor,
right.
Pam Bondi, the attorney general of Florida, and Brown, the former Massachusetts senator, among others. But in any case, in this call, it was clear that Trump wants to double down rather than take the advice of people like Newt Gingrich, who distanced himself, and then he turns around and attacks Newt Gingrich. So,
that's extraordinary. That's so extraordinary that he would do that. But I do think it's notable that nobody's withdrawing their endorsements of Trump, right? They're all tisking him, but they're not withdrawing their endorsements. They're hedging their bets still.
Well, that just shows what craven low-life, supine weasels they are.
Weasel is a good word, yes.
Yes.
But, I mean, it is extraordinary. And I have been, you know, mulling your theory, Ian, that Trump might find a way to wriggle out of the race. And I think, you know, it could happen. It could definitely happen if he finds a way to create a narrative, and which is what he's about, right, with this judge, that he is so aggrieved and being treated so unfairly that there's just no reason for him to stay in. That indeed could happen. I've always questioned how much he really wanted to be president as much as he wanted to run for president, you know? And my theory had always been, well, that he really kind of savored that idea that he would fall just short of 1237 delegates, the number you need to secure the nomination on the first ballot, and be denied the nomination, you know, having secured almost that number. And now he's really kind of screwed himself by winning the amount of the number of delegates he needs to get to win on the first ballot. So I don't know what's going to happen. And I think anybody who says they know what's going to happen is, I would take with a grain of salt. And so that's why I continue to say that he could win. Because everything's crazy, America is crazy, and stuff can happen that we haven't thought of, right? I mean, I keep remembering the video that Bin Laden released in 2004 that really made it possible for George W. Bush to win, or the stealing of Ohio, of the votes in Ohio that made that election possible. So I'm always a little cautious about saying so-and-so cannot win, because they're so nuts or whatever, you know?
Well, I guess my feeling is that I just don't see how he can continue because it's so clear that he doesn't know what he's doing. And that it, combined with the fact that he probably ran to increase his brand, Trump, and wasn't that serious. And it's a, you know, again, it's a bit like the last scene in the movie, The Candidate with Robert Redford, where he wins and then he says, what do I do now? That's led Sid Blumenthal to suggest that Trump is the dog that caught the fire truck.
You know? That's a great phrase, and kudos to Sid for that.
So that's my sense that's the only thing to explain the craziness that's going on now, and rather than put together a campaign and try and reach out, as they always do in general elections, to the center, to moderate, he's going the opposite direction. And in the case of the judge, I'm not sure whether that's not just his MO all along, that he just scams people, and when they sue him, he either intimidates them into dropping the case, or if he can't, he goes after the judge. But it's just a slash and burn tactic. Take no prisoners.
But I think it's compounded, Ian, because the case, the Trump University case, the fraud case against Trump and Trump University, is, you know, I mean, that is likely to sink him as a candidate, right? I mean, it's just so, as more and more is exposed, and the judge released all these documents that show just how deep the fraud went and how all the strong-arming of all of these people to get them to part with their money. So it's compounded by the campaign, by the fact of the campaign, and the only way to combat in the campaign sense, and I think this is where Trump may actually know something more than these campaign advisors, in a sense, is that the way he has analyzed it is that the only way to get past that is to delegitimize the judge in the public eye, or at least in the eyes of his supporters, of Trump supporters. And it's perfect that the guy is Mexican-American, because then that is, you know, concomitant with the rest of the Trump message, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's more complicated than I agree with you that it would always be in his nature to go after whoever is prosecuting him, or whoever is a judge that's going against him, or a plaintiff who's suing him. But I think that his reluctance to take any advice on this that would be kind of conventional political advice also has to do with his notion of how this is going to play in the campaign. So I think it's really tough to know.
Mm-hmm.
So, he's so nuts. It's so hard to know.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. And she's currently a columnist for The American Prospect, where she just wrote the article, Yes, Donald Trump Could Win the Presidency. I think, though, just apropos what you're saying, the real firewall, in effect, that Trump is fighting to maintain, and it's all tied up in this Trump University case, is that he is a con man, as
right.
Romney said. He's a fraud.
Yes.
And that he doesn't want the fact that he's a fraud exposed, and particularly in this case where he preyed upon the very people who he's gotten excited about voting for him, just regular folks
who are
mad as hell at the conditions in this country of the disappearing white man, if you will, of the fact that the establishment bailed out Wall Street but left Main Street languishing.
Right, and the fact that it's Main Street is important, that these are entrepreneurial people. And when you look at who comprises the Tea Party, a lot of those folks are small business owners too.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right, you really got something right there. The kind of people who would go to Trump University are exactly the kind of people who are his supporters.
Right, but the truth is that he doesn't give a damn about them.
Right.
And that he's using them and manipulating them. And that's who he is, and that's what he does, and that's why he's rich and why they're poor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I just don't think that obvious fact, that's the last thing he wants to get across.
Sure. So go after the press, right? Delegitimize the press when the American people already are inclined. I mean, they've never, it's been a long time since they thought well of the press. So that's an easy target, right? And then try to delegitimize, the judge who's making so much trouble for him. So I think you're right that he's desperate. But I think that this desperation strategy is one that it may not win him the general election, but it will still play well to a segment or to his followers, because it's all about being aggrieved and mistreated.
Right, but meanwhile, he's running for president of the United States, which is an extraordinary position to have, to be the nominee of one of the two major parties.
Right.
And he clearly doesn't know what he's doing. He can't put a campaign together. He doesn't want to put a campaign together because he doesn't want to listen to anybody.
Right.
And the kind of people he's got around him are either flunkies like Lewandowski, who's never, run anything, maybe,
right.
even somebody running for dog catcher. And he's got this other guy.
Well, he ran the New Hampshire chapter of Americans for Prosperity.
That's right. For the Koch brothers guy. And his big rally was he organized a bunch of people to show up with assault rifles.
Yeah.
Which is, by the way, what could happen in Cleveland, because Ohio is an open carry state.
Open carry, yeah.
And all of Trump's people are if they get riled up, they're likely to show up there parading around with guns. But I think that what's going on, though, is that he's really totally out of his depth, didn't really want this job in the first place.
Well, I think that's probably true.
So what...
in our discussions, you mentioned that you saw it as a brand-building exercise, and I think that's correct.
Right.
That he saw it that way and didn't expect it to get this far.
But so how does he get out of this trap? I don't I don't see how he does, continue... His two parts of his ego. One, he's got this oversized ego to begin with.
And right, and it's a contest, right?
But that would indicate, he's just too proud to quit, and he wants to win. And he said in his conference call, I'm going to win. That's what I do, I win.
Right.
That's what he says on the one hand. But on the other hand, as he keeps repeating these same hollow, increasingly nasty lines attacking people, the whole public are going to get tired of him. And I think that if he's facing public ridicule and humiliation, he'll find a way to pull out and blame it all on the press and on his enemies.
Well, I am not going to dispute you on that, right? Because I just don't know.
Well, neither do I, by the way.
You know, this election is making me so crazy. But my, and so if he does, Ian, then what happens? Let's say he pulls out. What happens?
Well, I guess they go back to the white knight strategy of Paul Ryan, which would be so much better for the Republicans anyway.
Yeah, but that pulls him out of the House. I mean, I think it's possible if they were to, well, it depends on when, if, okay, let's say Trump decides to, that he either sort of just, you know, is made, you know, it just flips out and has to resign or find some way to get out. Then if he's chosen a running mate, then presumably by that time the running mate becomes the candidate. But if he hasn't, I don't know who it would be, but I do think as a running, my theory on the running mate is that it will be chosen by the Koch brothers because he needs their ground operation. He doesn't have a ground operation. So, and the Republican Party has an anemic ground operation because they ceded that ground to the Koch brothers, right? So the ground operation is Americans for Prosperity. That's why Lewandowski is still there. That's the ground operation he needs. And the other little offshoot ground operations, they've got one called the Libre for outreach to Latinos and one called Generation Opportunity for outreach to millennials. But anyway, and the Koch brothers have the data, the voter data files that Trump wants in their data operation called I-360. So he needs them and they need him if he's going to be the candidate because their voter data operation is useless if they don't get all the data from the biggest national contest, right? So that means that I bet that they're going to get to choose the running mate. And my uninformed prediction is it'll probably be somebody like Pat McCrory, who is the governor of North Carolina, who's introducing these bathroom bills, or Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana. Both of those guys are locked in very tight, difficult re-elections, and they might welcome a chance to get out of state if they're going to lose.
Right, but wouldn't the Koch brothers be looking at the next president in 2020 in terms of the – they'd be grooming somebody for the next presidency. And
sure.
I'm not sure either of those two guys could make it all the way. The same thing, by the way, on the Democratic side. I don't see Hillary Clinton, assuming she wins tomorrow, being the being a president for more than one term. So whoever her vice president...
Oh, really? You don't?
Well, she's 69, and Trump is 70, by the way. He's older than her.
Yeah, but she's 69, but she seems strong. She seems...
Yeah, I know. Strong. But the two terms is a long time for somebody. You know, she was pretty worn out after being Secretary of State and after that bruising run with Obama. I don't know
right. How
much stamina she's got. In any case, I think the calculus would be on both parties' side to groom people for 2020, assuming...
Well, you would think that, but that never seems to happen.
Right. Right. Well, that's why maybe, you know, the white knight strategy would be the one, you know, rather than groom somebody, just bring somebody in who's got a chance of beating Hillary Clinton, assuming she is the nominee.
Right.
But this is speculation, but it's informed by the fact that it's just manifestly clear that Trump is flaying about like a madman, which is what he is, and that this is a big hoax on the American people. And more than that, it's a big hoax on the people that are voting for him. They have reason to be angry, and they have reason to be disgusted and fed up with politics as usual.
Sure.
But they couldn't have a more fraudulent representative for their interest.
Do you think at some point they're going to realize that they've been had?
I don't know whether that'll happen before he just can't continue with the fraud, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's a fraud on so many different levels. And now he's riled up this judge, so he's not about to back down on exposing the fraud of Trump University.
Right.
Well, Adele, I thank you very much. I know this was a highly speculative discussion.
But so much fun.
Well, no, I think we're not totally off the wall here. I hope our listeners don't think so.
Right. And great to be with you, Ian.
And talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes on covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently a columnist for The American Prospect, where she just wrote the article, Yes, Donald Trump Could Win the Presidency. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into whether the recent historic move by the German parliament to recognize the Armenian genocide played into the hands of Turkish genocide denialists. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nicholas Danforth, who's a doctoral candidate in Turkish history at Georgetown University. He's the editor of the cartography blog midafternoonmap.com, and has an article at Foreign Policy, The Impeccably Bad Timing of Germany's Armenian Genocide Vote. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Danforth.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Nicholas. And the caveat at the beginning of your article, in reference to the German Green Party co-chair Cem Özdemir, who said he led the vote and it was a successful vote in the German Parliament. And he said there is never a favorable time to speak about something as dreadful as genocide. So, given that caveat, nevertheless, your feeling is that the German Bundestag played into the hands of Turkish genocide denialists, confirming their belief that the accusations are inspired by anti-Turkish politics rather than historical truth.
Exactly.
So how do you get around that? Because we know the historical truth is the truth, and Turkey's been in denial. But at the same time, we also know that Erdogan is playing on their nationalism and paranoia, et cetera, and it's not hurting him, and he's the guy that, you know, somehow you need to restrain his increasingly autocratic rule.
Well, and that's the problem. It seems like in a lot of cases, resolutions like the one that Germany just passed, it's almost as if they're presenting recognizing the Armenian genocide as a response to Erdogan, as a way to stand up to him or as a way to try to pressure him. And that, I think, is exactly what he feeds off. And more problematically, that's what the whole Turkish genocide denialist argument feeds off, that this is something that's just done as a tool to attack Turkey, to criticize Turkey, when other powers have interests vis-a-vis Turkey that they're trying to advance. And it's that perception is very unfortunate, because if the goal of these resolutions ideally is to actually persuade people in Turkey to think about their history more seriously, then obviously this ends up being very counterproductive.
Well, you can't help noticing, and it may seem off the wall, but, you know, it feels a lot like the Trump campaign here in the United States. The more he's criticized, the more he attacks the critics and the press, and the more his own followers follow him and believe that there's a conspiracy out to get him. And once you get into that dynamic,
exactly,
it's a tough one. And there's no question that Erdogan is a very sort of authoritarian figure along the lines of Putin and possibly Trump as well. So,
and that's been the real frustration, I think, for people trying to deal with this abroad, is that how do you respond to that dynamic? How do you respond to someone who's been very good at using foreign criticism to actually empower him amongst his base?
So what about what's on his plate at home, though? I mean, he's obviously, he started a civil war in order to, with the Turks, or reignited a civil war with the Kurds in order to increase his executive authority. First time around, it didn't work. Second time around, it did. There's been a lot of blowback from the Islamic State letting off bombs and from the fact that there's a new insurgency going on. So is that getting to the Turkish people in any way? Because he successfully muted the opposition by passing a law that removes immunity from those who question the role of the MIT, for example, in the sarin gas that was the red line in Syria.
Well, that's what's been very discouraging, especially about the civil war with the Kurds that you mentioned, is that, I mean, something this is presented as something that Erdogan did single-handedly to enhance his power, and it's almost like the reality is a little more discouraging than that. What's actually been incredible to see is how, you know, the amount of support this has gotten even from opposition parties in Turkey, not the predominantly Kurdish opposition party, obviously, but the two other, mainstream, very nationalist parties in the country. This is almost, you know, for all that Erdogan's other aspects of Erdogan's power grab might be controversial, the going back to war against the PKK and unfortunately increasingly the entire Kurdish political movement, you know, again, discouragingly remains one of the more popular things he's done recently.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Danforth, who's a doctoral candidate in Turkish history at Georgetown University and the editor of the cartography blog midafternoonmap.com. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, The Impeccably Bad Timing of Germany's Armenian Genocide Vote. So in terms of the secular nationalists and the former kind of supporters of the military who basically ran Turkey for decades, they've been always opposed to the sort of Islamist tendencies, have they not? But he's won them over, is that what you're saying, in terms of this attack on the Kurds?
Well, it's remarkable to see the Turkish military in particular, which was, you know, traditionally seen as the bastion of secularism, exactly that Erdogan's been able to reconcile with the Turkish military. The relations seem much improved recently. In part, it's because of Erdogan's falling out with the Fethullah Gülen movement, which was a religious movement within Turkey that had supported the Turkish government. It originally was actually at the forefront of the Turkish government's efforts to crack down on the military. Erdogan had a falling out with that movement, went back to partnering with the military in a sense, and the war with the PKK has been the perfect vehicle through which they've been able to cement that new alliance.
So he's stronger than ever then, and not only is he going after the Kurdish parliamentarians and the liberals who joined in that bloc, he's certainly going after the Gülen movement. So is he unstoppable? Is he somebody that the majority of the people are still in the thrall of? Even though, I mean, have the chickens not come home to roost yet? The blowback from the bombs from ISIS and the civil war, that's still popular, right?
I mean, you saw, you know, the last election in Turkey in November, Erdogan got almost half the vote. You know, there's certainly, it's not that people don't have concerns about this. With there have even been some people within the party who've criticized the war against the PKK and the way it's being prosecuted. There were some deep concerns about how the Syria policy was playing out. But so far, you know, in part through this invocation of foreign conspiracies, in part by presenting himself as the one person who can maintain order and stability, you know, Erdogan has at the very least, you know, managed to maintain the support of half the country. And that, you know, I think most people in Turkey looking forward, you know, the ones who aren't necessarily supporting him, think that things are going to get worse before they get better at this point.
And given the role of Germany as a huge trading partner and lots of Turks have emigrated to Germany, your sense is that he's not going to retaliate too much against the German Parliament's vote because of these economic ties. But what leverage does Germany have in terms of these economic ties?
Well, and that's what, I mean, it's, you know, the kind of leverage that Turkey could use in terms of imposing boycotts. I mean, it's, you know, the kind of leverage that would hurt Turkey more directly than Germany at this point. And, you know, as you said, right, what you've seen in the past when other countries have issued genocide resolutions, Turkey is initially very angry. There's a lot of, you know, as I say, actually, for Turkish politicians, very useful opportunities to grandstand. Ambassadors are recalled, and then shortly afterwards, things tend to go back to normal.
But he's already picked a fight with Russia, with Putin, by ambushing that plane, Russian jet that was shot down, and that's had some adverse effects on the economy. I'm just curious to know what, you know, in terms of what Germany's strategy is here. The EU-Turkey refugee deal seems to be unraveling, and I'm wondering what pressure there can be brought to bear. And was Putin a model for? I mean, Putin has just written him off, hasn't he? He doesn't want anything to do with him.
Well, and that's how many more fights can Erdogan get away with picking at this point? You know, you've even seen that now he's making an effort to try to improve ties with Israel. Who knows how that will go? But there's certainly a sense that this style, this approach to international relations, has had some long-term consequences in terms of Turkey's isolation. And so, in that sense, I think Germany realizes that it's not in as weak a position as it's sometimes portrayed. People make it sound like there's, you know, this desperate need for Turkey as a partner to get the refugee deal or to get some kind of deal on refugees. But what you've seen, it's unraveling in part because it seems like European politicians aren't necessarily ready to make some of the concessions that are being asked of them. They're not willing to waive visa requirements as Turkey has requested as part of the deal. It looks like that will continue to be frustrating negotiation on both sides, where both Turkey and Germany very much do need the other's cooperation, and may not be able to get it.
So what's the role of the U.S. here? Because just going back to the genocide resolution that was recently passed by the German parliament, France, Argentina, Russia, Italy, I think about 20 countries have recognized that the Armenian genocide happened, and it was conducted by the Young Turks and by the Turkish authorities with the complicity of the Kurds, as a matter of fact. But the U.S. has not joined that, right? The last time it was brought up in the Senate Foreign Relations House Foreign Relations Committee hearing, the Obama tried to block it. So are we on the side of the denialists?
I mean, what's so frustrating about the United States position right now is that because the United States government has refused to recognize the genocide so repeatedly for what are quite clearly political reasons, you know, to avoid angering Turkey for all sorts of diplomatic, because of the complexities of our diplomatic relationship with Turkey, we've gotten ourselves into a situation where we actually can't recognize the genocide and not have it seem political anymore. Last year, the 100th anniversary, because that was such a significant day, it actually might have been one of the few occasions we could have done that, and had it, not seemed as explicitly political. But, unfortunately, given the situation we've gotten ourselves in, and given the way you often hear people talk about these resolutions, people saying things like, well, Turkey's not cooperating with us now, so this would be the perfect time to pass a genocide resolution. You know, it's like we missed our chance 20 years ago to take a principled stance, and now whatever we do is going to seem hopelessly politicized.
Well, for a while, Turkey wouldn't give the U.S. and NATO the use of the air base at Incirlik, which is very close to the front in Syria.
And that's been constantly one of Turkey's threats, exactly. Every right. Genocide resolution, they shut off access.
Right, so they've opened up access, and so they held that over the U.S.'s head. But on the other hand, in this long war with ISIS or Daesh, which the so-called coalition is involved in, and Obama promised to destroy and degrade Daesh, and it hasn't really happened. But the people, I think, that have proven to be the best assets that the U.S. and the coalition have in terms of fighting the Islamic State have been the Kurds, both in Syria and in Iraq. And that seems extraordinary, isn't it? That here you have the people that the U.S. has found to be the most cooperative, and yet the Turks beat up on them at every turn. And I just wonder what goes on behind the scenes here. Erdogan was a guy that really had a very close relationship with Assad, and then he fell out with him over Assad's brutal reaction to his own people demanding freedom. And they've had a huge falling out. And he was, more than anybody else, wanted to prosecute that war. And indeed, according to these parliamentarians that have leaked information from the MIT, the Turkish CIA, Erdogan might have had a role in sort of trying to drag the U.S. in by being involved in that sarin attack that was a red line for the U.S., which Obama eventually backed away from. So,
I think that has yet to be established.
That has to be.
I mean, right, I've seen those allegations. But.
Right, exactly. That is not, although Obama did say in his interview in The Atlantic, that long interview he did with Jeffrey Goldberg, that the intelligence on the sarin attack was not a, quote, a slam dunk. So clearly Obama was skeptical about the intelligence. But the long and the short of it is, this is what's been going on here behind the scenes. So who's got the upper hand here? Is this just a dysfunctional relationship? Or is it just because it's so difficult dealing with a guy like Erdogan?
No, I mean, the United States and Turkey have found themselves in a very difficult situation. I mean, right, you have Assad is clearly not someone anyone's defending here. You know, to the extent that the criticism of Turkey and the United States sometimes is that Erdogan's been too eager to go after Assad, yeah, that's certainly hard to fault from a moral point of view.
Right.
You know, at the same time, right, there's clearly, Erdogan seems to be engaged in a war against the PKK, which it's really hard to see how anything good is going to come out of it. It's hard to see how Turkey's going to win. The PKK, which is, you know, very closely linked to the groups that were coordinating against ISIS within Syria, you know, at the same time, it's not only recognized as a terrorist group by the United States, but does have, you know, a very brutal history of its own, you know, assault against civilians, Kurdish civilians quite frequently. So, you know, it's a situation where there aren't, you know, the United States has two partners in the war against ISIS who are at war with each other. Neither one is a perfect partner, and in some sense, given the delicacy of the situation, it's actually, you know, as you mentioned, America is now flying flights out of a Turkish airbase while, you know, using those flights often to support coordination with a group that Turkey considers a terrorist that's at war with its own military. So, you know, the fact that America has been able to balance this so far as well as it has is in some sense remarkable, although who knows how long it's going to be sustainable for.
And I guess the same applies to the Turkey-EU relationship. You know, it's a balancing act,
yeah.
Too, right? Yeah.
Given how quickly or how more dramatically the refugee deal could have dissolved, the fact that it's still unraveling instead of completely unraveled might be considered a success.
Well, thank you for joining us here. Not exactly a pretty picture, but a much clearer one, and I thank you.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Danforth, who is a doctoral candidate in Turkish history at Georgetown University. He's the editor of the cartography blog midafternoonmap.com and has an article at Foreign Policy, The Impeccably Bad Timing of Germany's Genocide Vote. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back assessing the latest polls in Britain ahead of the June 23 Brexit vote that indicate the Leave vote is edging ahead of the Remain vote.
Makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound that makes the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at iansmasters.com. And joining us now is Harold Clark, who's a professor in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. And his latest in books include Affluence, Austerity, and Electoral Change in Britain, and Austerity and Political Choice in Britain. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Clark.
Hello, Ian. It's good to talk with you.
It is good to talk to you too, Harold, but I must say the news is not that good in terms of those who want Britain to remain in the EU. The latest polls that you have provided us with here on the UK EU referendum on June the 23rd indicate as of June the 5th that the Remain vote is at 41% and the Leave vote is at 46%. So that's got people alarmed on both sides of the Atlantic, with the chair of the Fed, Janet Yellen, warning today of significant economic repercussions on U.S. markets, which will be impacted by an adverse reaction in European financial markets. So there's the unraveling, right, that things will go crazy in Europe and in the City of London, and that will affect Wall Street. And it's all a self-inflicted wound, is it not?
Yes, I think that the economic dimension of this, of course, has been heavily emphasized throughout the campaign by the Remain side. And now we see people like Janet Yellen, like Christine Lagarde, and others talking about the repercussions of a Leave vote, throughout the Western world.
But this is a part of the polarization in the vote itself, is it not, that's going on in the UK, where the Remain people are warning of dire economic consequences, which we just discussed, and the Leave people are warning of waves of immigrants swamping England's shores. So is this all about scare tactics and fear over reason?
It certainly appears to be, and it's remarkable how negative the campaign has been on both sides. And you rightly say that on the Remain side, it's been a very heavy focus on the economic consequences, as we just discussed. But on the Leave side, it's very negative as well. It's all about the negative consequences of immigration. Some of those consequences are said to be economic. Others are said to involve personal security, like terrorism and crime, and still others cultural threats to the English language, the British way of life, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been a litany of negativism on both sides.
Well, but the economic argument on the Remain side, even if it's been used to sort of put people in a panic, is nevertheless based upon facts, is it not? I mean, as much as market trends are based on facts, there's an emotional element or a mob or a herd element of the bulls and the bears, etc. But
indeed,
I think it's pretty clear that the European financial markets will go topsy-turvy and that will affect Wall Street. And, this will happen in the middle of an election. And, it has obviously a lot of consequences. And again, you can go back to David Cameron and say, why did you allow this thing to happen in the first place?
Indeed. I'm thinking back to his announcement of the referendum back in January of 2013. And, in retrospect, what a blunder it appears to have been.
Right. And the world is complicated enough without adding problems. And this one could turn into an incredibly big problem. So I guess that's the question: is the reality of the economic consequences, certainly there's more foundation to that than the idea that immigrants are going to flood the shores.
Well, economic argument first, Ian, I think in terms of how it plays, we have to remember that there is a very strong populist sentiment abroad in the UK. Our monthly polls that we've done for years suggest this again and again. And so to some extent, when the Remain talks, forces talk about the effects on the financial sector in the city and so forth, it doesn't resonate very well with ordinary people. They are tapping into this populist sentiment, and they say, "Well, it serves you guys right." And so, it's sort of a curious sort of backlash. Yes, we want to beat these guys up, and we may well say objectively, "By gosh, you're beating yourself up." But as a matter of fact, it doesn't appear a lot of public opinion doesn't see it that way.
Well, early on the program, we talked about both Donald Trump and his, doubling down, attacking the Mexican judge and his dysfunctional campaign and all of the attacks on everybody that seem to be increasing and the sort of crazy kind of populist nature of his presidential run, which is just in itself a bizarre story. But then the second segment before you was on Turkey with Erdogan, who's similar autocratic and megalomaniacal as Trump is.
Yeah.
And so do you have Trumpism in the United Kingdom with Boris Johnson and these other people whipping up all of this anti-immigrant stuff, which is certainly what Trump has done over here?
Yeah, so I think that started, of course, with UKIP and Nigel Farage, several years ago. And then, of course, it's interesting that that people like Boris have sort of jumped on this bandwagon and, of course, are much, in some ways, much more important and prominent figures. I think you're absolutely right on this. That's exactly what they've done. And as I say, like it or not, it resonates with a broad segment of the British electorate.
So how, on the countervailing side, though, there was a lot of favorable press with the new mayor of London, a Muslim, getting elected, and the guy that ran against him, apparently, who's the son of a billionaire, Jimmy Goldsmith. He apparently said some rather racist things in the campaign, but nevertheless, he lost soundly, right? So there are two strains here, right?
Exactly. And, one of the things that the Leave side has been hitting Cameron on, of course, is that he was very negative towards the new mayor of London, and in fact was intimating that he was some kind of a crypto terrorist threat of some sort. But then, of course, now he's on the campaign on the Remain side with him, and they're both campaigning for Remain. So, there's a lot of what apparent hypocrisy with the Remain campaign as well. And so it's really a nasty business, Ian. It really is.
Well, that was what Goldsmith was accusing.
Indeed.
The new mayor of being somehow an agent of terrorists. And, exactly. And you say that Cameron piled on in the same direction and now...
Well, he intimated it.
Of course, he's... He has to campaign.
Yes, indeed. And so the whole thing is a nasty business. It's been incredibly negative. It's just a torrent of negativity when you go through the morning papers and the BBC and so on. It's just negative, negative, negative. And so there's not much any bright spots or positive arguments for doing X or Y. It's all on the fear. It's all on the negativity. Remarkable, really.
And what role or what effect did the visit of President Obama have? He was there apparently to sort of inspire the young people to vote because they're going to vote to remain. At least that's the assumption.
But
they're also somewhat apathetic. So he was over there to give him to goose him a little bit. That seemed, I don't know whether it worked or not, but that was weeks ago, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. You know, it's several weeks ago now, and I think that there was a short-term effect. The British, you know, the British public have, over the past several years, been quite enthusiastic about Obama. And so, you know, it seemed to make some sense from the Remain point of view to have him over saying what he did. But, you know, as the recent polls that I sent you today suggest, that appears that effect has gone away.
So is he going to have to, to be a frequent flyer and go across there again? I mean, Cameron is not the best messenger, is he, to be the head of the Remain vote? I mean, he got the country into this mess by promising this ridiculous referendum just to win over the right wing and to try and neutralize UKIP, and now it's blown up in his face, and it could have terrible consequences for this anemic recovery we have here in the United States right during an election period.
I think you're absolutely right, it's not just the economic consequences of this decision, as you point out. It's the political ones as well. Another thing I would note is the kind of signal that it's going to send. It's going to send around the world in terms of the weakness of the, the Western powers and the European Union, and to Russia perhaps in particular. And so there's not much good news in the polls that I sent you today, to be sure.
Well, I take it that that Putin would like to see the leave vote, right? Because that just weakens the EU, and there's a isn't there a concern that would be the beginning of a kind of contagion that it would give aid and comfort to the right wing in France that's growing in strength? They want to leave. In fact, isn't Le Pen citing the UK Brexit as a kind of precursor for her?
Sure. I mean, all of these right-wing populist politicians, there's a lot of them now, will indeed take great comfort if there's a leave vote, and will use it exactly the way you say in terms of advancing their own agendas.
So does that argument work in the UK that, that Putin, who wants to, weaken the EU and NATO, that this vote will give him aid and comfort?
I haven't really heard that too much. This is more of things that I sort of hear. This is sort of common, common room kind of conjecture that I hear with colleagues. The one thing you do hear, of course, in terms of a gain of scare tactic, is that the failure of the European Union could lead to, wars again in Europe, like we had throughout the first half of the 20th century. And that has been floated quite explicitly and quite frequently over the last month.
Well, again, the June 5th polls show that Remain at 41% and Leave at 46%. So tell me about that's a trend, because Remain was ahead, right? So as you get closer to the vote, the Leave people are increasing. How many undecided do we have?
Well, we've got about 13% on trend undecided. And I was just doing a little mental arithmetic, Ian. Let's suppose that two-thirds of those people decided to vote Remain. It is still very conceivable that they would, the Remain side would lose narrowly, particularly as many people believe the Leave people are more likely to go to the polls. So the information I sent you earlier today is really not very good news, you know.
Well, no wonder Janet Yellen is warning. And is there anybody that could reverse this trend to stop this impending catastrophe? Because there's nothing good that can come from it, as far as I can tell. It's a weird kind of atavistic going back to the British Empire that doesn't exist anymore.
Indeed. I don't know. If you've brought in the President of the United States, you've brought in the head of the IMF, you've brought in the head of the American Federal Reserve, I'm not quite sure who you would turn to next. I think probably the most comforting news that you would see from the polling data is that there is a lot of softness and a lot of volatility in people's opinions about the European Union. So it's very much still a stay tuned message. There's a lot of volatility there, and so I would not want to make any heavy wagers right now.
Right, but you just said that the undecided, the 13% of the undecided, it would require 2/3 of them to decide to remain, and that would only bring it to a dead heat or in fact,
a close loss.
Right.
But, Ian, the 46-41 figure is not cast in stone either. That's
sure.
What I'm saying. There's volatility amongst people who are telling a pollster today that they're going to vote yes to leave. Might well turn around tomorrow, some portion of them, and decide at the last minute they want to remain. We've seen this kind of volatility in our data for over a decade in terms of attitudes about the EU. So, as I say, it doesn't look good, but it is not a done deal yet.
Right, but the other thing that gives one reason to be nervous about this is that the Remain people depend upon the youth vote, and there's no indications that they're going to show up, right? And that's what Obama went over there was to inspire the youth vote to, and he made it very explicit in his talks that that's what he's doing. So
exactly, and of course, all the data on voting behavior for many decades suggest that young people are less likely, and often considerably less likely, to vote than their older counterparts, and so. And you can see, not just Obama, but you can see on the Remain campaign, if you're following it, you can see that they are making efforts to try to get young people to the polls.
Well, is there just in the last minute then, is there anybody that it can appeal to the young vote? I mean, you know, is it time to get, you know, some movie star, rock star? I don't know, who would it be? Adele? I don't know.
Why not? A lot of those people, of course, are very firmly in the Remain camp, and I think that is something that might well be helpful, but not that helpful, I'm afraid. You know, it'll be of some moment, but not that much.
Well, I'm glad that you sent me that information, Harold, because it's pretty alarming, and it's certainly not a very encouraging trend that the Leave people have moved ahead of the Remain people, and the Remain people may not catch up, and we may have on the 24th, the very day that Donald Trump visits the UK, the global economy may start tanking. So,
yes, amazing, just an amazing thing.
Yeah.
And as I say, you know, it's not a done deal, but I, you know, even myself, I was surprised by the Leave surge over the last week or so. It's been quite interesting, and I'm not quite sure what to attribute it to.
Well, Howard Clark, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian. A pleasure to talk to you as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Harold Clark, who's a professor in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Studies at the University of Texas. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. And his latest books are Affluence, Austerity, and Electoral Change in Britain, and Austerity and Political Choice in Britain. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.